Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we are covering today, Tuesday, October 2nd, 2018. Activists say the September 12th peace deal is facing challenges.
The best guarantees for compliance with all provisions of this agreement lies in the ability and willingness of the parties and the revitalized Tigon to hold their commanders and officers to account.
And a government official says a hybrid court is not needed in South Sudan.
Why don't you use this money for peace? Bring peace first, and thereafter make people accountable. But when you talk of accountability, you are putting the cart before the horse.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Civil society activists in South Sudan are warning that the revitalized peace agreement may be in jeopardy because of repeated violations of cessation of hostility agreement by government and opposition forces. Onen Walter Solomon reports for VOA from Juba.
Speaking at a public forum in Juba today, Rajaf Mohandis, executive director of the Organization for Responsive Governance, says involving many stakeholders in the peace negotiations presented an opportunity for the conflict to be resolved. He says the revitalized deal contains sufficient provisions to end the conflict and to jumpstart the process of reforms and long-term peace building. It just needs to happen.
The best guarantees for compliance with all provisions of this agreement lies in the ability and willingness of the parties and the revitalized Tigon to hold their commanders and officers to account by themselves. That to us is a better guarantee.
SPLA spokesperson Major General Lul Roy Kong says government forces are ready to respect the ceasefire, noting President Kiir has ordered the army to observe the permanent ceasefire and to stop using hostile language about the rebels. Kong says the latest ceasefire violations that he is aware of occurred in the Mundu area of Ye River State and in the southern part of Western Lakes State.
From the time the ceasefire was signed to today, yes, it is true, we have had problems with the implementation for different reasons, but of course we would like to give the SPLA-IO and the Elmaja a chance to get in touch with his forces on the ground. His forces are scattered, he's having difficulties with communication, so we are also trying to give him time for information to filter down.
Kong is appealing to Citizen, the body monitoring the South Sudan ceasefire, to verify what has happened on the ground. Mohandis says civil society activists are also concerned about the stand taken by some donor countries who are reluctant to fund implementation of the peace deal. He also says some governments are putting certain conditions on the players involved before funding implementation of the deal.
We also feel that some of these conditions appear like you're telling me I'm very sick in the hospital and you're telling me I will help you, but please do the best you can to recover. Once you recover, tell me you have recovered and then I will provide you the help. We feel that it's important for the partners to work with the parties to ensure that they support the implementation of this agreement right from the onset.
Kong says some donors are justified in refusing to fund the implementation because some aid groups receiving donor money dissolve.
If you go and get support from the international community on ABCD, then you disappear. I don't think it is fair. It is a grand corruption on camera. I think there is a reason why some of the donors are dissolved. I don't want to mention some of these organizations because it would be a big embarrassment for the organization and even for the funders. But they know who they are.
activist also expressed concern about widespread impunity in the country, which they say affects the implementation of the agreement, particularly in establishing the hybrid court. Kong urged victims of human rights abuses to come forward and identify those who committed atrocities on them.
You cannot bring anybody to justice in the absence of a complainant. You must have a complainant for the accused to be arrested, tried, and sentenced when there are enough evidences.
Activists say unless parties to the peace deal ensure there is accountability for atrocities committed, and it will be more difficult to get funds from donors to implement the peace deal. For VOA News, I am Onen Walter Solomon in Juba.
Still on peace matters, a top South Sudanese official says there is no need for establishing a hybrid court in South Sudan to try those accused of committing crimes during the nearly five-year conflict. Dimo Silva Aurelio has more on that story from Juba.
Information Minister Michael Makuei called a news conference in Juba Monday, where he labeled a hybrid court a tool of regime change by the Troika, which is the US, the UK and Norway. Makuei said anything that presents an obstacle to the implementation of the peace agreement is unwelcome. He says the Troika countries and other regional bodies should first prioritize peace.
The hybrid court is an instrument that they want to use against the people of South Sudan, and especially the leadership of South Sudan. They want to use it in the sense that because the agreement gives the hybrid court the right to indict anybody at any time. Once you are indicted, you are apprehended, you shall look for decision.
Last month, the U.S. State Department urged the Kiir administration to set up the hybrid court to ensure that the perpetrators of crimes, including the mass killings of civilians, face justice. Human Rights Watch has made similar calls. The Troika also raised concerns about President Kiir's recent amnesty, which the three countries say could derail the process of accountability. Makuei says the international community should focus on bringing sustainable peace to South Sudan by promoting reconciliation, healing, and peaceful coexistence in the country, and deal with accountability later.
Instead of you pressing for the immediate establishment of the hybrid court, why don't you go in for compensation and healing process, for reparation and compensation, and you go in for the reconciliation and healing process? Once you start all this, automatically you will be dismantling whatever plans people have had for the hybrid court.
But civil society activists say the South Sudanese people need accountability, which goes hand in hand with peace. Jacqueline Nasiwa is head of the Juba-based Center for Inclusive Governance, Peace and Justice, a local NGO that worked with the Transitional Justice Working Group, which worked on Chapter 5 of the deal during the high-level revitalization forum.
This debate of saying peace first and justice later shouldn't come now after the peace is signed, because by virtue that Chapter 5 is part of the peace agreement and then it has to be implemented as it's in the agreement, unless if someone is saying like they have reservations, and then those reservations should have avoided Chapter 5 and the hybrid court. And from what citizens are calling for, they are calling for end to impunity.
Chapter 5 deals with the establishment of a hybrid court as well as compensation and reparations for the victims of crimes committed during the conflict. Nasiwa says the Kiir administration is trying to create the false impression that the hybrid court is a foreign concept.
If there is a thinking that probably the hybrid court is foreign and it's a Troika-led thing, that is misplaced. Because even if you are found to have committed those crimes, you still go to the normal court processes where you are given due process and you are given fair trial, where you even have to defend yourself and where you have your lawyer to represent your prosecutors or whatever.
Jamie Sokuk, a political science lecturer at the University of Juba, says the hybrid court is a crucial part of the agreement that the parties must adhere to for the sake of the people.
After 8 months, when the government is formed, this is where we will have the headache of the hybrid court of South Sudan. And you will not do it away because it is part of the agreement. It is almost a whole half of a chapter 5 of the agreement. So that's what will happen. But for now, you can relax for 8 months.
Makwe chastised the United Kingdom, the United States and Norway for pledging to finance the hybrid court in South Sudan before there is a total peace across the country.
Why don't you use this money for peace? Bring peace first and thereafter make people accountable. But when you talk of accountability, you are putting the cart before the horse and you will never get peace and you will not apprehend anybody.
Makwe says it is time to forgive, speak the language of peace and build trust among the parties. Others say it is time to establish the hybrid court. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
Young South Sudanese activists have petitioned lawmakers to ensure the government helps South Sudanese students studying outside the country. The young activists say South Sudanese students who received scholarship to study in Morocco, Egypt, and other countries are suffering because the government has failed to follow through on its financial obligations. Winnie Chirino reports for VOA from Juba.
Activists from a coalition of South Sudan youth organizations, which include people in their 30s, delivered a petition to the head of the Parliamentary Select Committee for Education. They say they want the government to do more to ensure their demands on the welfare of South Sudanese students undergoing scholarships in Ethiopia, Egypt and Morocco are met. Activist coordinator Michael Wani, the activist coordinator, say they have learned our brothers and sisters are subjected to intolerable and inhuman treatment as they struggle to study under their various scholarships, and he is calling for a thorough investigation.
Through the parliament, we call for a thorough investigation and comprehensive report by the Minister of Higher Education, Science and Technology on the status of these students studying under the various government scholarship in Morocco, Egypt, and Ethiopia. This report should be tabled before the House with facts to establish the outlining conditions of the students and propose way forward to resolve and avoid occurrence of similar incidents in the future.
Youth activist Maya Nemaya says less than 30% of the students can pass to the next class because they don't have the money for fees.
We call on the Minister of Higher Education and Learning and the Parliament to expeditiously enact a national scholarship policy framework and laws that will guide such program in future. Such policy framework will ensure that the government scholarship program embraces diversity, equality, transparency and accessibility for all South Sudanese.
Ahmed Mohamed Musa is the chairperson of the Parliamentary Committee for Education, Research, Science and Technology in the National Legislative Assembly. He says the government has resorted to paying full scholarships to the countries, but says students should note that costs for partial scholarships are shared with parents.
With the problems that our students are facing in all hosting countries, that if there is any problem, we will try to intervene in order to solve it. Although, Honorable August House, since maybe 2 years ago, they came with a resolution that we should not have any partial scholarship.
Ahmed also says the government should provide money for food and accommodation of South Sudanese students studying abroad on scholarships. This is not the first time complaints have been raised about the government's failure to pay the scholarships of South Sudanese students studying abroad. For VOA News, I am Winnie Serino in Juba.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, cholera vaccination campaign is launched in one African country. Find out where after this break.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
in a disagreement, do you stand your ground or compromise quickly?
Well, I will try to avoid going so far with that person, not to reach a point of fighting with someone. And I will try to avoid having attitude with that person because usually people, personality is different.
I cannot compromise quickly if I know that I'm right. So I have to stand on my grounds. Yeah, I do. I compromise. In this agreement, first time I have to first keep quiet. Then I think about it. Sometimes we also make do wrongs. You may think that you are right, but when you go back and sit and think twice, you may discover that you are the one in wrong.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus, and it's time for our Tuesday health segment. And today we are talking about cholera vaccinations. The World Health Organization and its partners are conducting a second round of cholera vaccinations in Yemen in hopes of preventing a third major wave of the spread of this fatal disease. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
A first round of cholera vaccinations was conducted in August in the Yemeni governorates of Hodeidah and Ibb. They are considered to be the most vulnerable to an escalation of cholera. 72% coverage of the target group has been reached. That amounts to nearly 390,000 people. In the second round of vaccinations, the World Health Organization reports more than 3,000 local health workers aim to reach an estimated 540,000 people, including children under the age of one. WHO spokesman Tarek Jazarevich says this campaign is a crucial component in various efforts underway to try to prevent another massive outbreak of cholera in Yemen.
We have been seeing the number of cholera cases increasing in Yemen since June, and this increase has been even more important in the last 3 weeks. And this is basically number of suspected cases, number of cases that were positive by rapid diagnostic tests, but also cases that were positive by tests done by growing the culture.
The World Health Organization reports nearly 155,000 suspected cholera cases and 197 associated deaths between January and the end of August. Since April 2017, more than 1,200,000 suspected cases of cholera have been reported, including 2,515 deaths. Cholera causes severe diarrhea and dehydration. If left untreated, it can kill within hours. The WHO says most people recover with the treatment of oral rehydration salts. People who are seriously ill will need to receive intravenous fluids and antibiotics. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Still on health matters, a preliminary report from the United Nations Economic Commission indicates African countries that invest in health care could see a stronger economy. As we hear from Ayen Deng-Bior, the authors say the data is convincing.
The data from the report shows that if African governments invest in health care, they're likely to see a boost in their economy. That's according to Saurabh Sinha, chief of UNICA's Employment and Social Protection section.
Very often in Africa, as many other countries also, the issue is that when governments spend less on health care, people's expenditures, out-of-pocket expenditures, increase. And that puts a very heavy burden on the people who are in the in bottom income quintiles and the poorer groups of people.
UNICA collected data from 48 countries across the continent and found that a one-year increase in life expectancy at birth results in a 0.1 increase in GDP per capita. Sinha says the number of countries spending more than $44 per capita each year has doubled to 31 between the years of 2000 and 2015. Africa's fast-growing population has made healthcare a top priority in some countries. There will be about 2.5 billion people on the continent by 2050, according to one World Bank estimate. About 60% of Africans are under the age of 24. Following high-level talks on Africa's health and finance, which took place on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly, Sinha said it is clear that governments should do more on health.
So as to reduce the levels of poverty and inequality in access to health. Because healthcare costs are increasing, governments are unable to meet those health costs. So that is a natural corollary to the previous message that is coming out very clearly.
Different challenges and experiences in each country demand a unique approach for each individual country. Sinha says the government cannot do it on its own, and it will need the private sector to increase innovation.
Now, the problem is that the private sector comes in for its own profit motive, which is fine. We don't have any quibble with that. But then the issue is that the private sector needs to work alongside the government and the public sector so that while they're meeting their profit objectives, they are also contributing to meeting the health goals. And that is something which is very important, and that needs to come in through a public-private partnership platform.
The report is a collaboration of UNICA, GBC Health, and the Aliko Dangote Foundation. It is scheduled to launch February 12th at the African Union in Addis Ababa. Ayen Dengbior, VOA News, Washington.
From Washington, we move back to South Sudan. The food security situation across parts of South Sudan continue to remain dire, according to World Food Programme officials. The officials say insecurity continues to hinder efforts by aid agencies to help hundreds of thousands of vulnerable people suffering from the problem. Wake Simon Wudu has this report for VOA from Juba.
Women are assembling scattered sacks of sorghum airdropped by WFP chartered planes in Kandak village of Ayot County, an area controlled by the SPLIO. Heavy cargo planes cannot land in Kandak because there is no airport. The place is remote but hosts more than 18,000 people, according to WFP. 28-year-old John Jallam, one of the beneficiaries of the food aid, says for the past several years, residents have relied on WFP for food. On this particular day, WFP is airdropping food aid. One person is to receive 15 kilograms of sorghum each, which is expected to last at least 2 months. Lam says while it's better than nothing, 15 kilograms of food can hardly sustain an individual for a whole month. Speaking in Arabic, Lam says when the food runs out, people resort to eating whatever they can find in the wilderness.
We eat the leaves and fruits of a wild tree called lalob, and there are also other wild fruits that we collect from the bush. There are also wild animals we could hunt for food, and also women go and catch fish and collect water lilies from the river. This somehow sustains us.
The WFP distributes sorghum, beans, vegetable oil, and a super cereal, a paste packed with nutrients which can be cooked as porridge. Thompson Firi is the WFP spokesperson in South Sudan.
We have started airdrops into this area as we are unable to move supplies either by road or by river into this location. So we take to the skies as a last resort. We have just started dropping sorghum. These drops will go on for about 5 more days until when we have enough food to reach everybody in the area. And then we can organize with our partner, Catholic Relief Service, distributions to all the people in need in this area.
After that, WFP works with the Catholic Relief Service to distribute the food aid. Onet Ioannis, an official at the Catholic Relief Service, says the area's population increased after thousands of people escaping fighting between government and opposition forces in nearby villages sought refuge in Kandak.
The hunger situation is related to with insecurity, with war related, because most of the people are moved from their own original location because of the war which we have in South Sudan to this new location. As you can see, this is the middle of a forest. This is not their permanent place. They moved to this location just for their safety.
A joint report released last week by the World Food Programme, UN Children's Fund, and the Food and Agriculture Organization shows that more than 6 million people in South Sudan, or well over half of the country's population, face extreme hunger due to continued conflict and insecurity. Johanna says despite receiving abundant rainfall, the locals in Kandak cannot produce their own food because of insecurity. Locals also told the South Sudan in Focus that the area is prone to flooding, which often destroys their crops before they can be harvested. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
Melania Trump, the wife of U.S. President Donald Trump, is in Ghana today on her first solo international trip as First Lady. VOA White House correspondent Patsy Wade-Kwasara is covering the trip. She spoke with my colleague Kate Pound Dawson a short while ago from Lilongwe about the goals Mrs. Trump has set for the trip.
Well, Tuesday is the first full day for Mrs. Trump. She arrived quite early in the morning at 10 a.m. and she was greeted by children. And then she departed to the Greater Accra Regional Hospital where she watched babies being weighed and also huddled with them and just, you know, generally did a very nice meet and greet with the mothers there and the babies. She then went to the Jubilee House, which is the presidential palace, to have tea with the First Lady of Ghana, Rebecca Akufo-Addo, and currently, right now, this is at around 2:30 in the afternoon in Ghana, she is in an embassy meet and greet with the staff and their family of the U.S. Embassy in Accra. And we don't have any idea yet what her schedule would be tomorrow because the White House has not been very forthcoming in terms of giving out detailed schedules and her itinerary due to security reasons.
All right. Does she remain in Ghana tomorrow or does she move on to Malawi?
Well, she's scheduled to arrive in Malawi on Thursday. So she will be in Ghana tomorrow. As I said, we don't have much detail yet as to what her agenda will be. And her second stop will be in Malawi. But she did mention through her spokesperson that she's very interested in all the African countries that she's scheduled to visit, Ghana, Malawi, Kenya, and Egypt, which she called four very beautiful and very different countries in Africa. So she will be in each of these four countries, not only highlighting U.S. assistance to the countries and also child and maternal health in each country, but also highlighting her platform, which is called Be Best. Now, this is a platform that she released or she launched in May of last year and consists of three pillars. The first one is child well-being, the second one is anti-cyberbullying, and the third one is to stop the opioid crisis. So again, you know, those are the kind of very warm, very friendly, very goodwill type of themes that she will be focusing on this tour.
That was White House correspondent Patsy Wade-Kwasara speaking with VOA's Kate Pound Dawson. That's our show for this Tuesday. We'll now leave you with Emmanuel Lasso singing Praising Dr. John Garang.
We've been
been listening to Emmanuel Lasso with the song praising the late Dr. John Garang Dimabior. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Check us on our Twitter handle. That's VOA South Sudan. And we hope you join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.